Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution. It sounds
It's Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, here with co-host Bill Westmiller. Today is Thursday, March 21st, 2013. And here are some of the headlines that we'll be looking at today. We're going to hear about Ben Bernanke. We talk about him a lot, and he made a rather amusing and interesting declaration this week in the typical way of central bankers by hinting at it rather than actually saying it. We'll look at that. We're going to take a quick look at what's happening with LIBOR manipulation. Yet another lawsuit being filed, this time by Freddie Mac. Bill's got a report on spending being up, way up, and how real income ain't up so high as spending is. I also have a report on Egyptian food prices that we're both going to look at, and if we can get to it, there's going to be a report from Bill about teen unemployment and a rather funny article he's got about Jesus saving. But we're going to start off the hour with some rather interesting news coming out of the European Union. Turns out that the little tiny country of Cyprus is going to be a bit of a test case. Well, at least that depends on which pundit you read. I tend to agree with those that say it is going to be a test case, and it is a test case because what they're doing is they're running into yet another bank crisis. Surprise, surprise. And this time they're talking about actually taxing bank deposits in order to cover the crisis. And what's particularly interesting about this crisis is not only is it the banks that are in trouble, but the government is in trouble. And the European Union, in order to help cover the whole situation, is saying, well, we'll help bail you out, but you got to tax the depositors to do it. And this is being seen rather widely as a rather naked attempt by the bankers, or banksters as we affectionately refer to them, to basically take depositors' money, which, Bill, I think is kind of fascinating when you consider that it's the banks who all along invest depositors' money, usually without the depositors' consent, and keep the rewards from themselves. Now that they're losing the money, they decide, well, let's take that from the depositors, too.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah, that's good policy, I think. Hey, you know, it's a winning formula, and it's worked for generations, so why change it now?
Well, the interesting thing about the story is that it's brazen. The governments tax in all kinds of different ways, and they take your income, and they take your savings and a variety of different taxes, and this just happens to be a very blatant, obvious grab of depositors' money to pay off banks and government debt.
That's absolutely true. And to expand upon this topic further, we actually have a guest with us today, John Ransom. He's the finance editor for Town Hall Finance. He's also a regular contributor. And Ransom's writings on politics and finance have appeared in the L.A. Business Journal, the Coloradan Statesman, and Pajamas Media, and Register Rep Magazine, among others. Prior to 9/11, he was a Wall Street exec, and he's joining us today to talk about this rather interesting development. John, welcome to the program.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Glad to have you with us today. So what do you think? Is this like the Bankster Union deciding let's make Cyprus a test case?
Well, I mean, I think it is kind of a test case. It's a test case for the bureaucrats from the EU and the folks who fill similar positions here in the United States to figure out if they can get away with just, you know, taking money out of bank accounts. I mean, one of the problems that we have in the world right now is not a lack of money, but in a lack of movement of money in the kinds of things that normally would happen in order to create kind of taxable events. And so, you know, one of the reasons why tax revenues are going down for governments is because money is not moving around. And so when you have money that's not moving around, the best way you can do is just reach into people's accounts and grab it for yourselves.
I think we'll both agree with you that there's not a lack of money. I mean, Ben Bernanke's creating it at the tune of, what, $85 billion a month or something like that.
Right.
I mean, ridiculous amount is being created.
Yeah, there's quite a bit of cash out there. If you look at, you know, another indicator, which is money velocity, and that's how often a dollar bill travels through the system, you'll see that money velocity has gone down quite a bit. And that's usually an indicator of lack of confidence in kind of the regulatory framework or whatever's going on in society. People are choosing to do things like buy treasuries right now because they don't want they're worried about return of principal rather than return on principal. They just want to make sure that they get their dollar back when they invest it. They want to make sure that, you know, they invest in something that's relatively safe, and at least with the treasuries, they can continue to print money.
What's spooky about this is that this is going to really put a serious dent in the faith of people around the world in their banking systems, because no longer can they trust that the money they put in the bank is going to be there the next day. You know, it might be confiscated 10% or 6% or whatever, but the money's just going to disappear.
The interesting thing is, since the Great Depression, we've had a variety of bank acts passed, and really the whole purpose of this regulatory framework that we put together is to build up investor and depositor confidence in the banking system. It's kind of a keystone of how the banking system works, especially a fractional reserve banking system, a system whereby, you know, you loan out more money than you have actually in deposits. One of the ways it works is by making sure that people have confidence in it so that you don't have runs on the bank, so that not everybody tries to withdraw their money all at once because they're all worried about the safety of banks. And now you see officials from the EU and I think even complicit with officials here in the United States, just reversing, you know, practically 100 years of tradition and 100 years of legislation, because they're desperate right now for money. They find themselves in a position where they can't make budget cuts, and the only way they can get what they need is by confiscating money directly from people's accounts.
But is it really that much of a variation from history? I mean, I know that it has never been done this blatantly before, but really this is the way banking has always operated. Banks have always, either through direct taking of money or indirectly through sucking the value out of money in the way that they expand the money supply, one way or another, they've taken value out of depositors' accounts for generations. There's nothing really new there. The only new is that they're just being more blatant about it, don't you think?
Well, yeah, I mean, but I mean, I think the point is it's not really the banks that are doing it. It's the government that's doing it. Banks certainly are adept at taking other people's money, loaning it to a third party, and then, you know, taking the difference between what they've taken from the depositors and what they're getting on interest from, you know, people that they loan it to. That's what the banking business is kind of based on. You know, this is the first time, though, that we've seen the government try to reach in as kind of a bank levy. You know, they've talked about it in the past, about doing something like that, but they've never actually really gotten to the point where they've proposed it. In the 1930s, however, you know, Franklin Roosevelt, confiscated gold. It was a crime to actually own gold. You had to turn all your gold in, and they priced it at $20. And then, you know, as soon as the government got all of the gold in exchange for certificates that they priced at $20, they changed the price of gold to $35. And then that way they ended up, you know, kind of screwing the taxpayers and screwing the people who had given up their gold to the government.
Yeah, that was the point that occurred to me as you were discussing how they'd never done it before, because as you point out, they did do it before. There's an example of how they did it. It's just a question of how you put it together in such a way. Can you put it together in such a way that the public will accept? And they managed to get the public to accept that one. Although I'm not quite sure what will happen in this country if they try it here, and I don't rule this out. I think that they very well might try this here as the spam starts to hit the fan, which it must eventually do with all this monetary expansion. But when it happens, the question that I think a lot of people are going to ask is, well, what about FDIC protection? You know, where does that fit in? And I don't think anybody knows the answer. Do you?
Well, I don't think it applies. I mean, it's a direct tax on, and it'd be like if they taxed the, you know, for example, they have a property tax on your house that you have to pay, and you pay it at a mill rate, you know, every year, and, you know, it'd be the same thing as going to your bank account and saying, well, now we've appraised your bank account, and it's worth $100,000, and now you owe us, you know, 15 mils on that. And so it's not that radical an idea, but it does shake it's a reversed kind of a long-standing tradition here in the United States that the money that we pay the federal government is not their money. I mean, we're coming from a place now, in the United States and around the world, but really more here in the United States, kind of a sea change, where there used to be this assumption that all of the taxpayers' money was the people's money, and that we were first entitled to it. And it's gotten to the point now where government is really making the argument, and we've heard it before with some of the liberals talking about, well, you use the streets, don't you? You use the police, don't you? You use the schools. You cannot be successful without all of those things. So in reality, it's all of our money, and you owe us this. And that's kind of a very different concept than we've had here in the United States, where we've had this individual property, we've had individual property rights. It wasn't life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness that the Constitution was originally bound to guarantee. It was life and the pursuit of property, basically.
Yeah, that's essentially what it was. The other thing that occurs to me is that this whole process is playing out in such a way that if it were to happen in this country, well, first of all, if it happened in this country, I think they would probably try to rely on FDIC first, although I don't think that's going to go very far because, if I remember correctly, a couple of years ago, they were borrowing years ahead from the banks just to cover, getting them to pay their fees in advance just to cover existing FDIC requirements. So right. If there was another major crisis going on, I don't think FDIC would go very far. But secondly, I think that because of that fact, that the temptation to go to something like a tax, if you will, on deposits is really going to be an admission that FDIC can't cover whatever the losses are. So that's why I was a little bit questioning, whether or not the FDIC would actually apply. I think your point's a valid one that they could easily bypass FDIC, but I think in terms of the public consciousness, it might be a different story.
It's possible.
One other question that occurs to me, too, is, as Bill was pointing out, this shakes the foundations of the banking system. And, in fact, already they're talking about a possible run on the bank in Cyprus. Actually, I think we consider it an existing run on the bank because they're on a bank holiday, and bank holidays happen because of runs on the bank. And the whole purpose is to make it look like there's not an actual run going on the bank. So if you're going to have a bank run in a small country like Cyprus, which makes total sense, I mean, if I lived in Cyprus, I'd probably do the same thing, try to get my money out, then what makes the authorities think that there won't be similar runs if they try the same thing elsewhere?
Well, there will be, and I mean, I think they solved it in Cyprus by freezing assets, by saying they deny the flight of capital. Yeah, you can take small amounts out, and they're not going to deny people the ability to take $300 out from an ATM, but that's not really the money that they're after. They're after the bigger money that is subject to restrictions on wire transfers and things like that, and so. I think it probably would. Even Paul Krugman said if you wanted to start a run on the bank, this is the way to do it. And so, when Larry Summers, Paul Krugman, and I all agree it's a bad idea, it's probably a pretty bad idea. One thing I do know about this administration, however, is bad ideas have a way of turning back up, kind of like a body always gets back to the seashore.
Well, we know that you're not a fan of the administration, so I'm glad you cleared that up.
3 points. Great. I'll try to make it quickly. First of all, when you say how the banking system works, I think that's an oxymoron. The banking system doesn't work. Secondly, this is nothing new. In fact, the government of Ireland has been taxing deposits for several years now. When they had a big financial problem there, they implemented the DIRT, D-I-R-T tax, on bank deposits. And just this past December, they increased the tax 10% in order to raise money to cover the debts and obligations of the Irish government. Mm-hmm. So the Cypriot plan is basically a different type of tax, which is more direct. So it's nothing new, but it's also, as John was pointing out, the way the government makes money, most of its money, is on the income tax, which depends upon rollover. turning over money, people spending money and collecting money, and every time it moves, they get a percent. And when the economy slows down and the activity of the currency slows down, then they have no choice but to start taxing wealth. In other words, assets in place, such as bank deposits. Now, the interesting foil on this is the politicians don't want to admit doing that. They don't want to take people's money in order to pay government debts. So what the Cypriot government is now talking about is reducing the amount of tax on deposits and taking away assets from pension funds. Not government pensions, mind you, but from private and quasi-governmental pension funds, so that they get, they're basically moving the paper of the pension funds from one account to another in order to pay off the banks.
Right. And you know, they floated that idea here in the United States. There has been some talk about levying a one-time tax on people's 401ks and IRAs. Hasn't gone very far, but there has been some proposals from the left that have talked about that because again, that's kind of a static source of money. You don't have to rely on doing the right things. And that's really what this is all about. This is about a government that's done such a poor job of managing our system that has piled so many requirements and so many regulations onto the banking system that frankly it's broken. We used to do 600 initial public offerings on Wall Street back in the early 90s, and this was before the go-go 90s of the late 90s, and now we're down to 80 or 90 initial public offerings a year. And if I had told you 20 years ago that the world GDP was going to grow from $25 trillion to $65 trillion, and America was going to largely sit on the sidelines during that, you would have been incredulous that what happened to the United States? Well, we've become the IBM of the world. IBM, was a big, powerful corporation until the personal computer came around. And if I had told you, 40 years ago that once computers were going to be dominant everywhere, IBM was going to miss the trend completely, you would have been incredulous about that. But that's really the system that we're stuck in, is that we have a broken system. We have a system that where they've almost deliberately broken the banking system over the last couple of decades, so that you're right, it does not work. It does not serve people the way it's supposed to, which is to make money available so that we can all live our lives and build our businesses and work and play and retire, with some measure of security.
Amen. The gospel according to John.
I've never been a fan of Dodd-Frank either, and I certainly agree that the banking system is extremely broken. I was glad to hear you say that it was broken over the last 20 years, because I think you started off saying it was the current administration, or at least hinting that the current administration broke it. And they've certainly done their part, but I think we can also blame the prior Bush administration and the Clinton administration, and then certainly the Federal Reserve and all those, because they've been the ultimate player, despite the fact that most of the people on Wall Street, interestingly enough, failed to admit that fact. But nevertheless, all this happens primarily because of their monetary expansion. I agree. This is it's not only a broken banking system over the last 20 years. I would argue it's been broken since 1913, when the Fed was established, and even before that, simply because fractional reserve banking is by definition broken. And it's not a system that preserves or protects wealth. It's a system that usurps and extracts wealth, and does so from basically defenseless depositors. So I think it's been a very long-term problem.
Yeah, I mean, it is essentially, by definition, inflationary, and you have to ask yourself, if we didn't have inflation at all, would we, we might not have inflation if we had a fractional reserve banking system, and if that were the case, would we see the types of increases in the stock market, for example, that we've seen, or is that largely just a trick of Ledger Tremaine, which just kind of makes it look like things are moving ahead and that we're always progressing, when in fact all we're really doing is seeing inflation in the system.
Well, I think there's two issues there. First of all, you raise the question, will we see the kind of gains we see in the stock market? And my first reaction is, I don't care. Frankly, I don't think it makes that big of a difference what the stock market does. I think it's true that the stock market has been largely driven by monetary policy over the last 20 years, so therefore, whenever they expand the money supply, the stock market goes up. But I don't think it's necessarily a good thing. So, again, I don't really care what that indicator says. If we were to have a what I call a level-steady money supply, which is what you're kind of getting at here,
right?
I think that we'd have to change the way that we measure economics. I mean, right now we measure economics in terms of GDP, which is absolutely silly because GDP, the main component of GDP is government spending, so it's going to be a gigantic incentive to increase government spending in order to make GDP look better.
Right.
I think also we need to come up with economic measures that don't look at it from a gross aggregate point of view, but rather look at it from the point of view of individuals, because the current measuring system basically puts tremendous weight on the very largest entities, which are the large corporations. And
right.
You know, if the large corporations are doing well, then it's deemed that the economy is doing well, which, as we've seen, is not at all the case. I mean, there can be huge disparities between what the corporations are doing and what the rest of society is doing. So,
And we talk about this regularly, you know, on Town Hall Finance, that there's this great divorce that's been going on between Washington, Wall Street, and Main Street. You know, Wall Street is largely divorced from the happenings of Main Street right now, and although the market continues to go up, that's not necessarily a reflection of what's going on in Main Street. And this is, I think, the bigger point in all of this, is that these indicators that we talk about, whether it's stock market performance or we look at inflation or we look at unemployment rates, those indicators that we've come to rely on for the last 100 years to kind of tell us what direction we're going in no longer apply. We've so messed with the system. We've so gamed the system, the government has, that they're broken. We can have a unemployment rate that's continuing to decline at the same time that the unemployment situation is deteriorating rather than improving. And it's kind of a false indicator right now of the condition in the economy because, you know, for example, they all saluted last month's employment report where we added jobs, but there were like 450,000 part-time jobs created. There was a net loss of about 250,000 or 270,000, I think, full-time jobs. And so how is that good? Well, it's not good for us. And we've so gamed the system right now where a lot of these economic indicators that people have come to know and expect, like GDP, no longer apply.
Right. And in fact, not only do they no longer apply, they've actually been designed to help perpetuate the fraud. I mean, you mentioned
right.
unemployment
well,
and CPI, but they, I mean,
yeah,
those
yeah,
are two rates
exactly.
that have been so gained that they don't even mean what they used to 30 years ago.
That's right. And that's really the point. I mean, they can come out with a number and they can make it mean something that really, or they can define it as meaning something that really means the direct opposite of it. And we've been living with this system. You know, I point this out, periodically to folks that, you know, right now an associate's degree, the average graduate with an associate's degree makes a better salary coming out of school than somebody who gets a bachelor's degree. And so what do we say about a system that is that broken, where that education, which we don't value, the associate's degree, and we place a higher value on the bachelor's degree, provides more economic security and a better return on investment than the one that we place a higher value on. We have broken this system. And until we stop thinking Republican, Democrat, conservative, liberal, and we start to look at systemic reform of our political system, we're going to be just stuck running in place until we're Greece or Cyprus.
Yeah, I'm not sure how you get.
There's an essential myth that needs to be preserved by every politician, and that is that the government can create something from nothing. That it can generate benefits and values where they didn't exist before at no cost to anybody. And that's basically the whole purpose of the banking system is to sustain that myth, that they're
Correct.
Creating something valuable from nothing.
Correct.
There's also a truth that needs to be passed along. The truth is that government breaks your leg, hands you a crutch, and says, see, without us, you couldn't walk.
Right.
That's right.
There's a very good bank that's readily accessible to everyone that pays anywhere from 5 to 15% interest. It's called a mattress. put your money under your mattress.
Right.
Especially
if
gold
is silver.
I don't know.
I think you take this money and stick it in the mattress. Take this money and stick it in the mattress. You could be in real trouble. I mean,
yes, and my mattress is open for your deposits anytime you wish. So.
Well, because of inflation, you just by having your money sitting there, you're earning the difference between what the dollars used to be worth and what they are currently worth, rather than having it in a bank and having it taxed.
Well, that's right. I mean, that's where it's getting. You know, that's the reason why no matter how much liquidity that they create, you know, that money is still just essentially going to very few places. And then that's really kind of the farce of the whole thing. And, you know, they are finally acknowledging that they're probably in this next, you know, this next session of Congress, they're probably going to have to do something about the too-big-to-fail banking problem. But, you know, it took Eric Holder to come out to say, well, you know, frankly, I just can't prosecute, you know, a John Corzine because, you know, if I did, it would shake the banking system so much, confidence would be so shaken in the banking system that it would be bad for our national economy, it would probably be bad for the worldwide economy. And, you know, I got to tell you, if it's something that big, yeah, break it up. You got to break it up and sell it.
But isn't a so-called bank too big to fail, isn't that inherent in a fractional reserve banking system?
I don't know. I mean, we managed, you know, for a long time before we got rid of Glass-Steagall to have, you know, smaller banks. And we had relative stability in the banking system for the most part, with the exception of the savings loan crisis that we had. But again, that was also real estate, monetary policy driven. You know, I don't know exactly what the answer to the question is. I grew up, you know, my grandfather was a banker, my father was a banker, and I worked on Wall Street. I feel fairly comfortable that in and of itself, the banking system is not responsible for this. I think it's the regulations. What really makes me laugh is that you hear liberals say, well, we deregulated the banks, and that's really what the problem is. I mean, you know, if you know anything about the banking system, hardly were they ever deregulated. Now, they did repeal Glass-Steagall, which allowed them to operate outside of the contiguous states that, you know, Glass-Steagall kind of kept them to certain activities outside of the investment business, and you could only operate a bank inside or with the contiguous states around which they were surrounded on all sides. So there were some ways that we kept banks small. And frankly, I like community banks very much right now. I mean, I think community banks serve a vital function. And I think the ones that have made it through that are not going to be messed with by regulators are probably fairly good investments here. But I don't know necessarily the answer to the question that you ask. If it's just a fractional reserve banking system, I do hear arguments that I'm persuaded by in terms of pegging the dollar to the price of gold, because I think it provides a disincentive to messing with the money supply. But honestly, I don't know what the answer to that question is.
I have on numerous occasions on this show ranted on the whole notion that the past 20, 30 years was a period of prosperity, and basically disagreeing with that notion in the context of what you were saying. The take I usually have is that if this was a period of relative stability, then it was the stability of having our financial system run by gentle gangsters. Whereas now we have the Mean Joe Green gangsters taking over. And,
well, and that's true.
From my perspective, I mean, gangsters are gangsters.
Well, I think what you're looking at, I mean, I think one of the things that you're looking at is that there has been, just like the Industrial Revolution brought a lot of social change, the rise of computers, the desktop computer, and the ubiquity now of computers have really instituted a lot of changes out there. There's a lot. We work completely differently today than we did, you know, 20 years ago. Our labor force is completely different in the way we work, and our productivity is completely different than it did 20 years ago, and even more radically, 100 years ago. We, to some extent, we have a society that's based on, an industrial workforce, and we no longer have an industrial workforce. And some of the things that you're seeing happening right now, I think, are a result of those social changes. And it will take a while to cycle through the system before we get, you know, to the point where we know what this is going to look like. On the other hand, the other thing that's going on is we've had a kind of unprecedented expansion of wealth in worldwide, and it's not happening primarily here in the United States. It's happening in other countries. It's happening in places like China and India, and the developing nations over the last 20 years. And we've noticed, especially in the last 10 years, that's happening. To some extent, I think what that has done is it has forced a bubble mentality. I don't even know if a bubble mentality is right, but a bubble phenomena where, frankly, there's more cash out there than there are good places to invest. And we have gone from one place to another place to another, whether it be dot-coms or real estate or biotechs. We have gone from one place to another place to another place where we've had asset bubbles. And part of that is because of the really unprecedented expansion of wealth in the world. This is, you know, more people are moving into the middle class worldwide than ever before in human history. And I think that's going to continue. And I think we're struggling in the same way that we struggled in the 1920s to contain kind of that unprecedented expansion of wealth that happened in the 1920s with the governments. So while I do agree with you that you know, to some extent the phenomena is related to the last 20 years, I don't think it's necessarily because the banking system in and of itself since 1913 hasn't been inherently bad. I think it's just a model that isn't working for the biggest, you know, the biggest economy that we've ever had in the world.
Bill, did you want to get one more comment in before we go to break?
Sure. Oh, go ahead. You want me to comment? I've been talking.
No, Bill. Bill was trying to say something. I was trying to give him the edge away, so to speak.
No, I don't want to get too deep into economic theory, but it occurred to me a couple of days ago. I was talking about a different subject that there is a truism which isn't always true, and that is economies of scale. And this is something that Marxist theory has assumed, that the bigger the corporations would always get bigger, and it's an assumption built into our economic expectations. The bigger you are, the safer you are, the more money you're going to make. But they totally ignore the fact that this is a curve. There are disincentives and diseconomies from largeness. And I think what we've done over the past 5 or 10 years is we've peaked the top, and now it's the biggest ones that are in the greatest danger of failing. In other words, it's not the economy of scale, it's the diseconomy of being too big to respond to the market.
Isn't that what the business cycle is about? Is that as the economy gets bigger, it expands more rapidly than it can organically sustain, you know, eventually it collapses in on itself and it has to kind of reset itself and rationalize again. And I think we go through periods where big is good, and I think we go through periods where smaller is good. But those are kind of economic choices that happen, you know, in total, rather than in camera, you know, kind of in a bigger picture scenario. So
I don't know. For example, AGI, it was assumed to be the safest, most profitable, biggest, financial institution in the world. They failed.
I think I agree with you in that sense, is that especially when you have one of something, and especially in the banking industry, I think having some diversity in the banking industry is certainly a very good thing, and it's something that we lack right now, and I think our banking system is more at risk today than it was in 2008.
I agree.
Well, on that happy note, I think we'll have to go to break. But before we do, John Ransom, thank you for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
And we'll be back after these messages. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network. Well, Bill, back here on the Freedom News Hour, and Bill, as we were talking toward the end there with John, especially when we made reference to the Fed, I was thinking about the report you gave a couple weeks ago about how Bernanke was bragging that he's had the best record on inflation in generations or something like that. I can't remember exactly what he said. And then this past week, he lets it be known that he, quote, feels no personal responsibility to stay at the helm until the Fed winds down its unprecedented policies to stimulate the economy. It struck me as like a cut-and-run kind of a thing. But he was trying to say that, oh, I've just been competing.
There's three interesting implications in what Bernanke had to say. The first implication is that he's tired. Now, he's not tired of running the world's biggest economy. What he's tired of is justifying it. He's encountered so much flack from Congress and from these senators that, like Rand Paul, that to ask him questions. My goodness, he has to answer these questions. I mean, that's very depressing. But he's been there for 7 years, and I guess he's due up for the end of his term in December. Guess who he's talking to as a possible replacement for himself?
Oh, gee, I can hardly imagine. Could it possibly be one of the too-big-to-fail three?
It's Timothy Geithner, who was the god of the bailout TARP and other programs during the interregnum, is going to take over the Fed, and he's going to solve all the problems. The third implication was that he strongly implied that this zero interest rate system and the buying of treasury bonds and all of the quantitative easing he's been doing has to be phased out. And he doesn't want to be responsible for that. He doesn't want to start backing away from the policies he's been advocating for the past 5 years. And so it's an implication that, hey, something has to break here. And I don't want to be the one there to pick up the pieces.
If he does get his way and Geithner gets his job, maybe they also push for Hank Paulson to get the assistant Fed chairman. That way they could get the complete influence from the original three right back there in the Fed where it belongs.
Yeah, there you go. I mean, I am totally fascinated with the commentary on the meetings that those three had with the banks. And I think probably Geithner and primarily Geithner was the one who basically said to the bank, we're going to give you money whether you want to take it or not, because we cannot let people discover which of the banks need it.
Yeah.
Which is, how insane can economics get? We're going to force you to borrow money because we don't want to tell people
insane.
Which ones are at risk.
I mean, they're pretty good at being insane, I think. I think it's fair to say,
Yeah.
You've got years of experience.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. There's another incidental thing. I don't know if I sent it to you or not. The Fed has been pumping money into Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. Well, now Freddie Mac is suing Bank of America, J.P. Morgan, UBS, and so on.
That's right.
Because they were involved in the LIBOR scandal and reduced the rates. Now, this is humorous because, Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae basically created the housing boom on their own because they could pretend that they had these low rates. And they took the number from the LIBOR and from the other banks, and they made, they bought loans and mortgages with these teeny tiny percentages, usually with a balloon involved. And now they're upset that they made all these loans at a rate that was far below anything the market demands. So they're suing Bank of America to get the money back that they're losing day in and day out, and they've been bankrupt for a year and a half at least. Ever since the bubble exploded.
It's amusing for two reasons. First, you give a very good reason about why it's amusing, because they were directly complicit in the buildup of the whole bubble in the first place. Mm-hmm. But secondly, it's also amusing because the standard line that has been carried out in the news media since the 2008 crisis, and particularly since the LIBOR crisis came to, or I guess you can't call it a crisis, a scandal, the LIBOR scandal came to public attention, is that what the LIBOR scandalers, if you will, were doing was they were basically trying to force interest rates up, which is not true. It's actually the opposite. In this particular case, the lawsuit alleges that the LIBOR regulators were trying to keep the rates artificially low, which is fascinating. It's absolutely fascinating because, as you point out, they like the low rates. That's what they built their business on. And yet here they are coming out and not only acknowledging what the LIBOR scandal was really all about, which was keeping rates low, but complaining about it.
Yep. Yeah, no, that's, and they want the banks now to bail them out even more than the government already has.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely true, and quite funny too. The other thing that occurred to me, you were mentioning Timothy Geithner being the heir apparent to Ben Bernanke, and have you seen the movie Too Big to Fail? The drama of how Hollywood views the crisis as it unfolded in September of that year.
I saw reviews of it. I didn't actually see the movie.
There's a great line in it at the very end. Paul Giamatti plays Ben Bernanke, and they pull off the thing where they get all the seven biggest banks in the same room. They make them take these cash injections that half of them claim they don't need and the other half definitely do need. Of course, they don't want to announce to the world who got what. And after that's all done and they're concluding the whole thing, somebody asks the question, so what's all this going to accomplish? And the guy playing Bernanke, Giamatti, says that, well, this is going to encourage the banks to lend the money out. And then there's a pause. He says, they will lend it out, won't they? And that ends
there's
the movie.
Somebody creditworthy to loan it to, they will. But if there isn't, they won't. Yeah. So, and the other side, the footnote to this process was that the Fed decided, I don't know, it was a year ago or 2 years ago, that they were going to start paying interest on the deposits the banks made to the Fed. And the interest rate was higher than the interest rate in the free market. And therefore, the banks had no incentive whatsoever to make any loans to anybody except the Fed. So that's where all their money has been sitting for the past 2 years, collecting nice interest, and they're making profits, and they're doing just fine. But it's not circulating in the economy. It's circulating between the Fed and the government and the banks. And they're making money.
Well, it's the banks.
It's crazy. How's that?
It worked. It saved the banks. What more do you want?
Yeah, it did. Yeah, it worked real well.
That was the whole point, right? They're too big to fail, so they didn't fail.
That's right. That's right.
God help the rest of us, but, you know, hey, the banks are there.
Well, it's like GM's too big to fail. You know, and they managed to create this illusion that GM has paid off all of its debts and it's making a profit and so on and so forth. Until you get down to the nitty-gritty, you discover that the U.S. government lost somewhere between $30 and $50 billion on the GM deal, even if they sold all the stock interest that they got today on the free market. They still lose $50 billion. And, you know, that's not saying anything about all the people who took a haircut, is a new word in jargon, when GM settlement was announced, because they basically took almost all of the investors' assets, all of the bondholders, and wiped them out, gave them 60 cents on the dollar or something like that. So anyway, that's just one little footnote to the too big to fail thing.
I have a feeling this whole notion of a haircut is going to enter lore, you know, public lore historically, as time goes on. It's going to kind of fall into the same category as swimming with the fishes. You know, to have the same kind of role.
Yes.
That's really
the problem is you can only do a haircut to a certain point, and then you get down to bald skin. So what do you call it when they start skinning your scalp?
Scalping, I believe.
I guess. Anyway.
So is something to look forward to, I suppose. on the sad side,
federal spending. Are we doing federal spending?
Well, sure, we can do federal spending. Let's do that next. Go ahead. You want to pick up on federal spending? Go for
it. Yeah, sure. Well, it's the hysteria about the sequester has been all in the news, and how it's so disastrous for the government. I'm going to have to shut down parks and lay off.
I like the way you said it. All in the news. That's the only place it's been is in the news. But go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. It's, you know, a terrible thing that the government has to reduce their spending by 1% from what they expected it to be. But the interesting thing from the Congressional Budget Office is that in the first 5 months of 2013, they have actually spent $30 billion more than they did last year. Now, Congress, the sequester thing was supposed to save $1.2 trillion over 10 years, which means $120 billion a year, right? But the fact is, according to the CBO, Star Trek.
I like yours better, first better.
Congress will need to cut $399 billion this year just to bring the federal spending back to the level it was. And there's no way that they're going to do that. They're not going to add on to the sequester an additional haircut on the, you know, the spending is not going to be reduced. The politicians refuse to do it. And as long as they refuse to do it, basically we're playing games with the money supply, borrowing money from China or Canada or whoever it is, and continuing to play the game that government can create wealth.
Absolutely. I like the CPO. I love that screwed up acronym. Seriously, I mean, think about what you can do with that one. You could have the Congressional Punks Office or the Congressional Pugilists Office. I mean, you can get some really nasty things with P to really describe what's going on there. That's pretty cool.
Well, one of the things I overlooked when we were talking about Bernanke is he said, I'm dispensable because we have at the Fed hundreds and hundreds of people with PhDs in economics. We have all the smart people that know what to do, and they can do it without me. So maybe we should call this the C3PO, the artificial intelligence running the economy. It's a whole group of people with PhDs running supercomputers to calculate exactly what the interest rate ought to be next week.
You know what I just realized? There's the old joke about PhDs, and it applies perfectly. It applies perfectly because Bernanke and company have been piling up the money supply. And what's the joke about PhDs? It's piling it up higher and deeper. I mean, it's perfect.
I like that. I like that. Can you write that down?
Yeah, that's a
joke.
It just occurred to me. What a great analogy that is. Yeah. You know, advanced college degrees, it amounts to nothing more than, you know, I got past a committee. I don't really know squat, but I got past a committee, so I got a doctorate. Is the same thinking that got us this massively expanding money supply. What? Who would have known? Now, there is,
like,
of course, the serious side. The serious side of all this is that there are a lot of hurting people as a result of all of this.
Of course.
A lot of those people are here in this country, a lot more than perhaps the American public are aware of. They're here in large numbers, in measured in millions, not just in thousands or hundreds of thousands, millions or even tens of millions of very hurting people, including people who are unemployed, people who are, you know, struggling to make ends meet with part-time work and that kind of thing. And I want to touch on that in a moment, but I also want to remind everybody, it doesn't just happen here. This is a worldwide phenomenon. It's not just going on in the United States, as we've talked about in the past. And it's showing up, among other places, in Egypt, where very little is known, actually, about what happens with their monetary system, with their banking system, because it's all very much under wraps, particularly since the Muslim Brotherhood took over. But one thing we do know is that their food prices are skyrocketing. And when food prices skyrocket, you can listen to all the arguments that they make all you want to about shortages and all that kind of thing, but the bottom line is it means that the monetary system is completely in free fall. And we're seeing that in major ways. I mean, just this past week, CNN was reporting on what they call a food revolution going on in Egypt. Now, why is this important to Americans who are suffering and we don't need to worry about the world's problems? Well, this is actually a precursor of what very likely could happen here. And just to give you a little bit of a taste of it from the CNN article, it says low-income households in Egypt are being hit by soaring food prices, placing a major strain on many poor families in the country who are struggling to put basic staples on the table. And they give an example. Inside a small Cairo apartment, Hawaiti Nagay is dicing a few tomatoes in her kitchen. Her three sons have arrived home from school and they are hungry, yet the only food available is these tomatoes and a piece of bread, and this will be the boy's only meal for the day. And it goes on along that same vein. This is the serious side to what happens when you mess with the money supply. And I guess the one hope I have, Bill, is that maybe this time around, because of how interconnected the world is, particularly with the internet, particularly through the media and so forth, at least seeing some aspects of it, maybe, just maybe, people are going to start making that connection this time. What do you think?
Well, I mean, we're talking about the information revolution, and there's some truth to that. But you know, people can listen to the show, and the people can read the news, and they can understand what's going on economically. It doesn't give them the power to do anything about it. They can't buy food. They can't. There's nothing they can do that will change the economy that's been destroyed by the government. I mean, it's the same thing in Argentina. In Argentina, they had runaway inflation and billions of dollars in debt. They borrowed money and had these fantastic social programs. And now the banks won't lend them any money, and they're in the same predicament as Egypt is. People's money is no longer worth anything. It's the inflation tax all over again, and it's something that, sadly, we're going to have to look forward to. That's going to happen here.
Well, I think it's fair to say, even though there's an infinitesimally small micro chance of it ever happening, it is possible for people to do something about it. But what it entails is basically a majority of the population changing their voting habits, not voting for a lesser two evils, not voting for any of the major politicians, and just simply refusing to give support to the status quo, as happened recently in Italy when a brand new political party arose out of nowhere. It wasn't particularly a well-principled party, but it arose out of nowhere, particularly among the young, and took like 25% of the vote. That kind of event would have to take place, hopefully, with a party that actually knows something about economics. But you're right, the odds against that happening are very, very long.
The leader of the Italian party was a comedian.
I'm sorry?
The leader of the Italian party that took 25% of the vote was a comedian.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, who knows? The next candidate for president may be Stephen Colbert.
I wouldn't rule that one out either.
He couldn't fix things. At least he'll make you laugh while you're going down the tubes.
You'll feel better about it. If you're trying to figure out what to put in your stomach tomorrow morning. But we also, before we touched on the Egypt story, I mentioned that the same thing's happening here, and you were looking into what's going on with teen unemployment. Why don't you share a little bit of that information while we have a couple minutes left in the show?
Actually, I wanted to talk about the real income.
You want to do that one? Okay.
Which kind of ties in with teen unemployment to some degree. In spite of what people imagine that things are improving, there's a group called Advisor Perspectives that did an analysis of real income, real household income in the United States, and determined that rather than household income being up 28% since 2000, which is what it is in nominal dollars, if you take into account the simple inflation in the economy of the currency, the actual real income in the United States is down 7.3%. The median household income for everybody is down 7.3%. And the, you know, the same kind of numbers apply to the teen unemployment, the minimum wage thing. The unemployment rate is down to 7.7%, but that totally ignores the number of people, and this is something John was talking about, the number of people who've just given up, number of people who move from full-time jobs to part-time jobs. For example, the unemployment rate for adult men is low, along with adult women, but for teenagers, the unemployment rate in the United States is 25%. For blacks, it's 13%. For Hispanics, it's 9%. Which is the proposition that the president has come up with is to, well, you just increase the minimum wage, and therefore they're going to have a lot more money in their pocket. They're going to have more real income. Well, it's not. It's fake income. So there's an interesting chart at this Advisor Perspectives pointing out that teen unemployment is directly related to the minimum wage. The higher the wage, it doesn't affect other people as much, but it does affect teenagers.
Yeah, I got to cut it there because we're out of time, Bill, unfortunately.
Okay.
I'll have to pick it up next time. But it's been a pleasure as usual.
Sure.
And we'll see you all next time here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody.